Dharma questions with answers from Pra Ajahn Chayasaro, recorded on the 4th of March 2007 in Pak Chong, Northeast Thailand. What is the nature of asceticism?
In our practice, when we are trying to find various strategies, techniques, ways of overcoming or abandoning mental defilements, negativity, one of the methods that we can use every now and again, not necessarily on a regular basis, is to go against the grain, to deliberately make things a little bit more difficult for ourselves than we do usually. And that extra effort and that pushing against old habit energy is sometimes the only way to deal with very deeply ingrained habits, things which normally seem to be resistant to our normal techniques that we've been taught. So monks were sometimes, for instance, fast for a certain number of days, reduce the amount of food they eat, perhaps only take rest in a sitting position rather than laying down. It's not that those things are good in themselves or necessarily will lead to any purification, but they're a way of just stirring things up a bit and putting some effort into areas which we find particularly difficult. But it is Buddhist asceticism to the extent in which the goal of liberation is firmly kept in mind, and in which the idea of the middle path is predominant. That means that practice which is the optimum for the goal that one has in mind, both the intermediate goal and the ultimate goal of liberation.
What are the characteristics of conduct for total liberation?
In Buddhism, we consider that virtue and virtuous conduct is a necessary prerequisite for the higher stages of spiritual practice. In the beginning, we have to give a great deal of thought and attention to the quality of our acts and our speech, so that we can live in a way that we leave no traces, no stains on our mind. There are no sense of shame, of regret that will arise in meditation and cause disturbance and be an obstruction to the development of inner peace, which allows the development of wisdom. So we see conduct, virtuous conduct, the ability to still the mind and to lead the mind out of distraction and negativity, and the ability to develop the wisdom and the penetration into the nature of things, which allows liberation to take place, as being inseparable. So the practice of trying to restrain one's actions and speech within the boundaries that one set oneself, whether they're the 5 precepts or the 8 precepts, 227 precepts, is very much part of the whole process of liberation.
What is the most essential commitment?
The primary commitment we make is to liberation, is to freedom. And that commitment has to be played out in every level, every area of our lives. So we will start off with that the commitment to liberation from selfishness and from attachment to material wealth. And develop the practice of giving and sharing in order to undermine that kind of selfish attachment. We make a commitment to precepts in order to liberate ourselves from bad karma through body and speech, which causes pain and suffering for others and also ultimately for ourselves. We make a commitment to practice of meditation in order to liberate ourselves from the hindrances of sensual lust and obsessions with the sensual world through anger, negativity, sloth, torpor, depression, laziness, mental proliferation and agitation and doubts and worries. All these mental states can only be abandoned through the power of meditation. And so the commitment to that practice is the commitment to that level of liberation. And the highest commitment is to the development of wisdom and understanding of the nature of this body and mind in order to undermine the fundamental assumptions and misunderstandings that we make about ourselves, and so to realize the ultimate liberation that the Buddha has taught us.
What is wrong commitment?
Well, wrong commitment would be when you make a commitment based on wrong understanding or through some kind of desire or attachment. The what's particularly dangerous is making a commitment to a particular person. Sometimes people commit themselves to a charismatic teacher or a monk, and then perhaps at some later period that monk leaves the monkhood, or the teacher is involved in some kind of scandal, and then people whose commitment has been made to that particular individual finds that their whole practice and their whole effort has been completely undermined. So the Buddha encouraged us to commit ourselves to the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha rather than to particular individuals. But you could also make a commitment to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha and to the correct objects of faith and refuge, but have some hidden agenda or desires, perhaps to become somebody, to get something of some kind or another. So that kind of getting greedy, desirous attitude can infect even a wholesome commitment. So to repeat, there is that committing to the wrong thing would be one mistake, but committing to the right thing in the wrong way would be the second mistake.
What is the greatest problem in maintaining effort?
Effort, if it's felt to be a burden and to be something you have to push yourself to do, is hard to sustain. That's why right understanding provides the prop and the support for effort. When you have a clear understanding of why effort has to be put forward and the drawbacks and the suffering which will arise if you don't put in effort, then it starts to achieve a momentum of its own. But if you still consider you're doing something that you don't really want to do, but your teacher wants you to do it, or because you think you should do it, then often that effort will slack. And then a common pattern is for people to go through periods of laziness and neglect, and then perhaps they hear something inspiring or something happens and they feel guilty and sad that they've let everything go and put a lot of effort in for a short period of time, and then that slacks off And so there's this period of hard work and holiday, which is not the way to develop spiritually. There has to be this constant effort at the rate which is not too not too tough and not too too slack, just at the right intensity to have this constant sense of making some progress.
What are the crucial distinctions between patience and perseverance?
Perseverance, persistence, means that you don't give up when things get tough. It means that attitude, you're going to stay with it, whatever happens, because you see the value of that. But to persevere, then you're going to need patience, which is the ability to be present to abide with things that you don't like, things which are you find unpleasant, whether physically unpleasant, like, say, heat and cold and hunger and thirst, or mentally unpleasant, things that you may find boring, oppressive, disturbing in some way or another. So we progress through that kind of perseverance through the inevitable ups and downs that will arise in practice, but we're able to persevere because we have that power of patience, patient endurance, the willingness and readiness to be with the unpleasant when it is wise to do so.
What is the most tragic mistake beings can make in samsara?
Well, I think that the worst thing is to be born into samsara in the first place, or to be content to be in samsara. And of course that's conditioned somewhat by the refusal to recognize the truth of the samsaric roundabout and the inevitability of repeated birth, old age, sickness and death for beings who are still full of defilements and cravings of various sorts. So this is why the Buddha put so much stress on right view or samadhi. That's where the Noble Eightfold Path begins, when you recognize that there is a dilemma, that there is a problem, that being born is in itself a problem. It's asking you questions. There's something that you have to attend to here. And if the teachings of rebirth are true, what does that mean to you? What does that mean to how you live your life? I don't think it's something you can just put off or try to forget about. You can reject it, but if you accept it, I think that that teaching has inevitable implications for how you live your life, how you spend your time.
Why are beings so often surprised when death comes?
I think we all tend to think we're the hero or the heroine of our life story, like on a Batman or Superman or some superhero. No matter how desperate the situation that the superhero gets in, there's one part of your mind that knows that he won't die because he's got to come back next week. He's part of the story. And we do tend to have that sense that we're indispensable, that we're the heroine, the hero of the story. We also tend to suppress or repress a lot of our anxiety about death, try not to think about it. In the West, people often consider conversation about death as being morbid or not something that should be talked about too much. It's depressing. So that contributes to the denial of death. And I think we often think in a magical way rather than a rational way. And perhaps the idea, because we've been alive all these years and we haven't died so far, that it's not likely to happen in the future. So even though we all know people who've died, and we see on the news every day, people watch the television, see death and destruction, but somehow it's not considered to be a personal thing, something that is going to happen to me. So we have the rational mind says, yes, I'm going to die, but every other part of us is saying, yes, but, or not yet, or at least not today.
What distinguishes good worldly from good spiritual analysis?
Well, a worldly analysis is usually one which has a worldly aim, maybe to make money, to be more successful, to become famous, and so using one's intellectual powers to analyze a particular situation in order to derive some material benefit from it. In spiritual analysis, our motivation is to find some way of abandoning defilements, or for replacing negative mental states with positive mental states, or for seeing the nature of all mental states as they are. To say they're impermanent, they are unstable, incapable of providing any true lasting happiness, and that they are impersonal, that they are ownerless, that they are without self, without any abiding essence. So spiritual analysis is either aiming at creating or increasing the power of mental, positive mental states, or aiming at a closer, sharper, clearer perception of the way things are.
What is the nature of yoniso manasikara?
Yes, yoniso manasikara is this analysis. And to give an example, if the mind is full of lustful thoughts, of sensual thoughts, in a way which is creating problems in our life, or particularly problems in meditation, then investigating, reflecting upon those aspects of the physical body which we find unpleasant and unattractive. So when a man looks at a woman looks at a man, there are certain parts of their body which are exciting and interesting, certain parts which are not so interesting, and certain parts I probably wouldn't like to think about at all. I don't think very many men thinking about women would be interested in their the snot in their nose, or the earwax in their ears, for instance, although they're every part as much of that the person's body as the parts that we find exciting. So you don't find men buying magazines with pictures of earwax or pictures of runny noses. So this is an example of taking up a subject of recollection, reflection, which directly counters some particular mental imbalance, or what we call a defilement. So this is the practice of replacement, using reflection to replace a negative mental state with a positive mental state. The other kinds of reflection are those which are particularly aiming at increasing our awareness, understanding of impermanence, of unsatisfactoriness, of not-self. So those would be the two kinds of analysis.
What is the nature of Indriya Sangvara?
Sense restraint means that we take care of our senses, take care of our eyes, take care of our ears, of our nose, our tongue, our body, mind. There are so many things calling for our attention, particularly in modern city life. And we need some kind of filter on all that information. And the filter that we use is the reflection on whether what we are looking at or hearing or smelling and so on leads to an increase in the positive and wholesome qualities in the mind or in the negative qualities in the mind. And so we train ourselves to avert our senses from, not turn towards those sense objects which are going to unnecessarily disturb us or just to create mental confusion, agitation. So there has to be that sense of what we really want to look at, what we really want to listen to, what is really constructive and creative and nourishing to us, and not just allowing ourselves to look at everything that comes into the range of our eyes, not to have to listen to everything that's going on around us. And in this way we reduce the input that comes into our minds, which means that we try to look at and listen to and so on those things that will be of benefit, true benefit to us in our lives. It means that our mind becomes much calmer, and we find that it's much more easy to concentrate the mind in meditation. Often when people experience a lot of agitation in meditation, they think that the problem is their technique. In fact, it's often just due to the fact that in their daily life, they've just taken far too much information, far too much data, and they can't handle it all, and it leaves that kind of agitated, unrestful state of mind, which is very difficult to deal with in meditation.
What freedom is the most important to establish in early practice?
Well, the freedom from regret and shame and any kinds of feelings that we're bad and unworthy, those feelings of low self-esteem, which are so destructive of the very interest and commitment to spiritual practice. If you think that you're a bad person or an unworthy person, then it's unlikely that you're going to be willing to put forth the effort to strive to realize goodness and peace and all those things that you have a right to experience in your life. So acting in ways that you enable you to have a feeling of self-respect, self-esteem, is the initial and I think important kind of freedom that we can experience in our lives.
What is the most persuasive argument for practice?
Why should we practice? What would be the problem if we didn't practice? But as human beings, we've got to be doing something from the moment we get up in the morning to the moment we go to sleep at night. And that's what we call practice. It's what we do. It's what we, how we act, how we speak, what we do with our minds. And I think that we have a wonderful opportunity as human beings to realize peace and liberation. And the Buddha taught that these are the highest things that a human being can realize. So when we have this marvelous potential, I think it seems the most intelligent thing to do to make use of that potential. Sometimes people say, I don't think it's necessary. Do you have to do it? Well, no, I mean, you probably won't die if you don't put effort into developing yourself spiritually. But if I could make a comparison to a child who says he doesn't want to go to school anymore because he can read and write quite well now and is probably enough for what he wants to do in his life. I don't think many parents would think that would be a very good argument. They say, well, I want you to study, you know, as far as you can for your future benefit, for your career and for your life in general. And I think that the extent to which we practice spiritually is the extent to which we can contribute something wholesome, worthwhile to the community we live in as well. So it's not merely a personal matter, but something which has beneficial results for one's family, for the society we live in, and for the world itself.
Why would anybody want to compromise stillness?
It's a strange thing, isn't it, that I think most people would like to be peaceful or to experience some peace in their minds, and yet often lead their lives in a way which severely reduces the possibility that they will experience peace in their lives. So we have this kind of inner conflict. One part of us wants to be peaceful, and one part of us is still very attached to all those things that prevent us from being peaceful. And even in the case that we do realize some peace through meditation or through perhaps just being in a very peaceful environment for a short period of time, there's something within us that panics and just wants to run away from that because it's threatening to our idea of who we are and the way we've lived our lives so far. So I think we begin to see as we look more closely that within there is a great deal of disharmony and inner contradictions and the things pulling us in different ways. And we're not in any way as rational and well directed as we might like to think. So I think it's quite normal that when the mind is going in the right direction, that we suddenly find ourselves running away in the wrong direction. And something we need to be very patient with ourselves, just recognize that, and gradually try to alleviate it.
What is the most stealing thought?
Mental activities which stir us up a lot are various kinds, and some people have a lot of lustful thoughts, some people a lot of angry thoughts, and what we're trying to develop in our practice are skillful means of stilling those thoughts in a way which feels natural and unforced. Thoughts can be very verbal, ones in which there are like words and whole sentences in our minds. Sometimes they're more visual. Sometimes they're a mixture of the visual and the verbal. And we each one of us have to find skillful means to deal with those challenges. When I was a boy, the televisions, when you turn them off, the picture would gradually fade, and then you'd have a little sort of little light right in the middle of the screen, and you'd watch that until it completely disappeared. And I think that for me, with a visual image, that's quite a good skillful means that you become aware that there's an image or a movie or something going on in your mind, and then you imagine it's like on a TV screen, and you turn off the TV, and you imagine you experience this image gradually dissolving to a small light and then disappearing altogether. The important point being here is it feels natural and unforced. It's not something that you're being very very violent with your mind or trying to get rid of the picture, but allowing it to fade. With thoughts, If you catch yourself verbal thoughts, catch yourself thinking a train of thought, then adding on a few words at the end of one sentence in a way which would allow that train of thought to end naturally is also a very useful technique that I found works very well. So if you're just thinking, what shall I have for lunch today? I think I'll have this or this, and you realize what you're thinking, and then but it's impermanent, or it's just another thought, something whatever works for you really, but it's a way of adding on to one of these sentences in a way that it comes to an end in a very natural, unforced way. So this is a way of to still the mind naturally by adding on to the image or the sentence in a way that leads to its cessation.
How can misleading energies be purified?
The energies in the body can, you know, in unskillful modes can be experienced as anger and jealousy and desire. But if we are skillful and we purify the thought, then that energy can be a support for practice. The energy which manifests as desire and lust and so on, if harnessed, can become the power of faith and devotion. If the energy of anger and the kind of habit of picking faults in everyone and seeing where everyone's got it wrong and getting very upset and self-righteous about that, that can be transformed into wisdom, the ability to investigate phenomena and to see how they arise, how they pass away, the faults, the suffering inherent in attaching to them a self, and so on. So angry emotion, angry thoughts can be transformed into wisdom. Lustful attached thoughts can be turned into devotion, can also be turned into loving kindness. It's a matter of just flipping that energy over and into a new channel.
What does Ujjupatipanno mean?
Ujjupatipanno is one of the characteristics of the noble ones, of the enlightened beings. And it's that practice which is straight, practice which doesn't waver, the practice which makes no compromises. There are no kind of zigzags, no shortcuts, no picking and choosing what to be practiced. But that is that practice with that total integrity and adherence to the middle way.
What is the most intelligent risk to take?
In practice, you have to be willing, of course, to experience some physical discomfort and also mental discomfort, particularly when you're dealing with very deeply ingrained habits, and to find freedom from attachment to the body and mind, sometimes you have to go against the grain. So there are certain risks involved in that, in the sense that it might lead to pain and difficulty, but it's one in which we feel is worth the risks. The great teachers like Ajahn Chah would say that you have to put your life on the line. It means you have to be fearless, and if you're still anxious about physical comfort and unwilling to do anything in any way threatening, either physically or emotionally, then you're not going to get very far in your practice. So you have to take certain risks, but not recklessly, considering that you don't have to take any care of your health or your physical body. I mean, certainly as monks, we don't use money, and so if we get ill, it's a burden on our lay supporters, and so we're careful not to be foolish in our practice in a way that it's going to lead to unnecessary illness or physical imbalance. But at the same time, there is that sense of willing to give things a try, even if they're a little bit daunting or dangerous.
What transforms goals into realities?
We have to establish goals for ourselves, both our ultimate goal of freedom from all suffering and defilement, and the perfection of wisdom, compassion, purity. But also we need intermediate goals that we can realize at regular intervals in order to maintain a sense of confidence and self-belief and the reassurance that we are progressing on the path. So it's a matter of one step at a time, doing the practice, applying oneself every moment of the day. If we put too much emphasis on the goal, then sometimes we can be a little bit careless with the details of practice. If we put too much emphasis on the details and we forget the goal, we can easily get led up blind alleys or get distracted into thinking that quite minor aspects of the path are particularly important. So there has to be this balance between the goals that one aspires to and being able to recollect them and keep them in mind, and at the same time to give that kind of respect and interest and effort with the small, sometimes quite mundane details of practice.
What is the limit of intelligent investigation?
The ability to reflect, to use the our wisdom faculty to develop the mind is an ability which is conditioned by the state of the mind. It's state specific, in other words. If your mind is full of agitation and thoughts and depression, anxiety, worry and so on, then that kind of intelligent reflection can't take place. It's just more noise in the mind. It doesn't really lead anywhere. But you've been reflecting in that way systematically with a mind which has a certain calmness within it, then there will reach a point in which the mind just puts that reflection down and goes into a very peaceful state in which there is no mental activity as such, a state of stillness. That state of stillness will last for a certain length of time which you can't control, and then mental activity will resume, and that kind of wise, intelligent reflection can take place once more. So the intelligent reflection, the ability to investigate the nature of things at its lower level is dependent on the ability to free the mind of the mental hindrances. And at the upper level, it means that there is still a certain amount of movement in the mind, in which can be the raw material for reflection. So once the mind goes into stillness, then that wise reflection ceases and then can reappear when the mind emerges from that peaceful state.
What purifies faith from ignorance?
Faith in Buddhism is primarily faith in the Buddha's enlightenment, that the Buddha was truly enlightened. Therefore, there is such a thing as enlightenment. The Buddha was enlightened as a human being, so we have a faith which we can't prove, that 2,500 more years ago, a human being called Siddhartha Gautama realized enlightenment and so became the Buddha. So our faith is in the capacity of the human being to realize enlightenment. And having that faith in the capacity, the potential for enlightenment in the human being, we realize that that must apply to ourselves as well. So in our daily life, moment to moment, our faith manifests as a conviction, a deep-held conviction, that we can abandon the unwholesome, develop the wholesome, purify our minds. And so with that faith, we're left no choice really but to try to abandon the unwholesome, develop the wholesome, purify the mind. And as we apply ourselves to that practice, we get results, at one level or another. And so our faith increases. Yes, the Buddha says if you practice in this way, you can reduce the amount of attachment and suffering. We give it a try and we see, yes, that's right. Buddha says if you practice in such a way, you develop meditation, you can start to experience these wholesome, beautiful mental states. We give it a try. Yes, it's true. So step by step, we verify the objects of faith. So it's not faith, a belief in certain philosophical tenets or dogmas, but it's a faith in what we can do as human beings. So it's a very practical faith, and one which we are compelled to put to the test every day of our lives.
What is the most serious beginner's mistake?
When you start to practice, it's very difficult, and you make a lot of mistakes. Even if you've got a good teacher, you still make a lot of mistakes. But that's not such a bad thing. If you have that attitude of learning and wanting to find your way, and often you learn more from your mistakes than perhaps you do from your successes. So mistakes are not a bad thing as such. But there is one mistake that you can make, and this is the worst and disastrous mistake, and that's to stop. Because as long as you're practicing, as long as you're putting forth effort, as long as you're listening to your teachers, then you have a chance of changing things around, of amending, of remedying the problem. But once you stop, that's the end of it. So this is the golden rule, to just keep going, and don't think it's only you that has problems or is finding it difficult. Everyone finds it difficult. Even the great teachers have had their struggles, and so it's not really, a matter of who makes mistakes or who finds it difficult. What really sorts things out is who's willing to bear with their difficulties and to overcome their mistakes.
How does earnestness make people happy?
Whatever you're doing, whether it's in your family life, in your career, I think when you have that sense of sincerity and earnestness and putting everything into what you're doing, it feels good. If you're say, working and you're trying to find the easy way out or do the smallest amount of work to justify your wage. And some people feel that that's an intelligent thing to do, to get paid without really doing very much. But in the end, I don't think that you make a profit because you just don't feel good about yourself and your life. So when you're earnest and you're putting forth your best effort, even if the results, particularly in the beginning, are not that encouraging, then you have that sense, well, I've done my best I can, the best I can. And that's a good feeling. As long as you keep that up, then things will happen gradually.
How does laziness compromise faith?
Well, faith, as I said, means faith that you can abandon the unwholesome, develop the wholesome, purify the mind. And that faith becomes strong, becomes invulnerable through the effort to put it to the test. Laziness means that you can't be bothered, or you've got other things to do, or you just don't want to do anything which makes you in any way uncomfortable, and you just like to hang out and enjoy yourself. So, of course, you don't put the objects of faith to test, and your faith gradually declines. So laziness is a serious obstacle.
What does Satyanurag mean in daily life?
There's a word in Pali, Satyanurag, which means to care for truth. And what that means is we don't claim that things that we don't have any personal experience of as being true necessarily. I mean, it might be true for us at that time and place. But making a firm distinction between what we believe to be true and what we personally experience to be true. It's very easy to get into this cyclical reasoning where I believe it because it's true. If it wasn't really true, this strong belief wouldn't arise in my mind. How can I know it's true? Because I believe it. Why do I believe it? Because it's true. And this is called not caring for the truth. So the Buddha says we're very, very clear about this. So a Buddhist may have a strong faith in rebirth, for instance, but at the same time, he says, I don't actually know that for a fact. I've taken it on faith, and I believe it to be true, but I don't actually know it to be true. So in your life, that principle is a very important one. Always to be very clear about what you actually know, what's merely a perception, what you believe is probably true, may be true, or you've just heard from other people. But don't claim things to be true, absolutely true, when you haven't any clear, direct personal experience of it. This is what's called caring for the truth.
What makes a life worthy?
I think a life which is worthy, noble, is one in which there is this effort to abandon all that is negative, harmful within us, and which we put forth that effort to develop all that is good and noble and beautiful in our life. And so we're, to use that old idiom, we're part of the solution rather than being part of the problem. And as you put effort into spiritual life, you do develop that appreciation for goodness, for kindness, and for virtue in a very refined kind of way. You can be made very happy by seeing other people acting well. And these sense of that one is unworthy is a particular habit, a particular way of thinking. It's just a noise in the mind, and that noise starts to diminish as you see that these good qualities arise through causes and conditions. There's no kind of owner there. You know, you're not the owner of the negative mental states, you're not the owner of positive mental states, but you're a vessel, as it were, and that there's not one single wholesome, beautiful quality which cannot arise in your mind if you apply yourselves to developing the causes and conditions for its arising.
What are the karmic consequences of following lust for ordained and unordained people?
Well, the Buddhist monastic is celibate, and for that reason, he has to be, or she has to be, very careful in his relations with members of the opposite sex. A monk, for instance, should not be alone with a woman at all, should not speak with her for more than six, seven sentences without another man being present. This is a way of protecting himself and also protecting his reputation. Might be someone who wants to make difficulties and to falsely slander the monk. So if the monk is very careful with his conduct and follows the monk's rules, then there's no reason why there should be any difficulties. In that case, lust will arise in a monk who's still not free of lust, but it becomes an object of reflection. It becomes an emotion, something to be understood rather than something to be followed. To follow it in a gross way might lead to expulsion from the monastic order or to serious offences against the discipline, which require quite extensive disciplinary proceedings to take place. So it's a very serious thing for a monk, and can radically undermine his sense of self-worth and contentment in the Sangha. For a lay person, then the five precepts are the standard. And in that case, if a man or a woman was to have to follow lustful desires and have sexual relations with someone who's already married, then this would be serious bad karma. In the present moment, at least, one can see that it often leads, or almost always leads, to other forms of misconduct, lying in particular, and undermines trust in families, and leads to all kinds of unrest and disturbance. So there are karmic results which are seen immediately, and those will depend upon the particular standards, the rules, the laws of the community one lives in. And there are long-term karmic consequences which may even ripen after in the next life.
How does craving determine the psychological makeup of a person?
As we look at our minds, we begin to understand more and more what this craving is that the Buddha is talking about, and how much it dominates our lives. It's something that's quite shocking, disturbing to recognize within ourselves. Not something that we like to admit, perhaps, that so much of our conduct is guided by the desire for pleasant feelings which arise through sense contacts of various kinds. How much we're dominated by desire to be, to become famous, well-known, successful, loved, respected, and so on. Desire to, craving to get rid of things we don't like. So there are these three kinds of desire which the Buddha pointed us to look at and investigate. Desire for sense pleasures, and a desire to become something, and a desire to get rid of things. And the more we look closely at our lives, the more clearly we see these things, then the more we see the importance of practice, because without the practice of the Eightfold Path, there's no way that we can really deal with this very deep, deep-seated cravings, which forms the core of our usual life and existence.
Why would beings want to increase lust?
I don't think that most people think of themselves as acting in ways which increase lust as such, but there is a strong pull towards exciting objects, and sexual energy is obviously a very, very strong instinct in all unenlightened beings, and that sense of excitement and energy and somethingness. There's something happening. There's something real and out of the ordinary and absorbing. That's something which is very powerful in human life. But because we don't tend to look at lust as a mental state, as something which arises and passes away, something which cannot ultimately fulfill our true desires in life, something which is, moreover, impersonal, conditioned, not really who we are. Because most of us don't pursue that kind of analysis, seeing things in terms of three characteristics, then we don't see the problem. It's something that we feel is an important and necessary part of our lives. So this is why the Buddha's teachings go against, counter the stream of the normal way of looking at things. We're taking a fresh look, recognizing what's going on, and our attitudes and values change as a result of that willingness to look again at what's really going on.
What aspect of sensuality is one that beings easily overlook?
Well, I think most aspects of sensuality are overlooked. We were talking just now about lust, which is the grossest, coarsest kind of sensual desire, and very few people see even that as problematic. But the milder forms of sensual craving are even more invisible, and most people would consider the absence of many sensual pleasures as things which would make their life meaningless or completely without enjoyment. So sensual cravings and anything that we grasp onto and attach to in the world for enjoyment and for fulfillment. So it might be very blameless kinds of things, which are real interest in sports or for entertainments and music and all these kinds of things. It's not that they're bad in themselves. This is not a Puritan rejection of the sensual world, but merely pointing out that as long as the mind seeks happiness and fulfillment in those objects, then it will never progress to the higher forms of happiness which are available and possible for human beings to experience. Having said that, it's not necessary to abandon all sensual pleasures to realize enlightenment. And there are certain, but there are certain boundaries and an ability to abandon sensual desires and at certain times, certain places, or to keep them within certain bounds and boundaries, so that they are as small and insignificant a hindrance to one as possible.
What is the influence of a personal history on a person's development?
Well, the Buddha taught that we've all been born many, 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 many times, innumerable times, and we're born into this world with baggage. We can call that old karma, and that's our sort of raw materials that we have to work with. And so that raw material, that baggage that we bring with us, is going to influence our experience of life and will manifest in terms of things we find easy, things we find difficult, things we're attracted to, things that we're repelled by. And in spiritual life, we'll find that we find certain things just very hard, certain things just very very easy or almost effortless. Some people who've developed meditation in previous lives, for instance, when they start to practice meditation in this life, find that they become peaceful very quickly because they've done the work before. So in terms of personality as well, whether someone is very outgoing or very quiet, someone's a very good communicator or someone's very inarticulate, these kinds of personality traits, whether they are conditioned by past life or even particularly the present lifetime and upbringing and family surroundings and so on, they're all going to affect one's life inevitably. The content in many ways of one's experience, but in spiritual life we're moving away from emphasis on content to process. So, and seeing also that whatever the personal history might be, and we're talking both of personal history in past lives and present life, it's something that can be seen, understood, and doesn't necessarily entail suffering if we attach to anything at all, a good or a bad quality, then we suffer. If we can let go of attachment, then we can be free.